Hi, and welcome to the Cancer Horizons podcast. Each week, we talk with patients, survivors, caregivers, advocates, or healthcare professionals and do what CURE does best, provide cancer updates, research, and education. A cancer diagnosis may be earth-shattering, no matter the stage or cancer type. But what happens when you're a young mother of three children without a current option for health insurance and you're given 6 to 24 months to live? In honor of Cervical Cancer Awareness Month, CURE spoke with cancer survivor Aisha McClellan in this episode of the Cancer Horizons podcast. McClellan shared how she advocated strongly for not only herself, but for her children's futures and was able to achieve remission, which she has been in for 4.5 years now. She also described how her journey led her to becoming an advocate for others through the SHARE organization.
My name is Aisha. I am a metastatic cervical cancer survivor. I'm almost 5 years out this year. I'm currently working with the organization called SHARE, helping to launch the cervical cancer program, which is going to focus on patient education and support. And I've also been working with UNC Chapel Hill, and I support their patient advocacy as well and the Cancer Outcomes Research Program.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. We're really happy to have you on. Can you tell us a little bit about your cancer journey and how you came to receive your diagnosis?
Yeah, so back in 2016, I had some, I just was having some weird symptoms that I couldn't really put my finger on. I had some irregular bleeding and back pain. It just kind of hit me out of nowhere. And so I didn't have health insurance at the time. So I went to the health department and they kind of just said that it seemed like a classic bacterial infection. And they gave me some antibiotics and sent me on my way. And I went home and it just didn't really sit well. Like, I just felt like there was something more going on. And so I went back a second time and was like, thanks for the antibiotics, but I just feel like there's something more going on. So they did a closer examination of my cervix and she said I had an angry cervix. And I didn't really know what that meant or how to take that. But she basically still said that the antibiotics should clear it up and I'd be all right. So I've just, I rarely get sick and I'm pretty in tune with my body. And so I just knew that there was something else. And so I went back a third time and they're like, we do see something. And so finally, it took me 3 times. And so they said that they did see something, but they didn't know what it was and that I should get examined. And so when you don't have health insurance, things are really difficult to navigate. So I was told that I needed to get a biopsy. And so I went to try to get a biopsy, but it was really hard because a lot of people don't take, self-pay patients. There's no insurance. And so then it was like, you could go to this resident clinic on like Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I'm like, when somebody tells you that you have cancer, it's not like you don't want to wait until somebody's Tuesday and Thursday. And then you have to call between 8 and 9 and you might be able to get in, you might not. So anyway, I finally found somebody to give me a biopsy. I was diagnosed with stage 2B cervical cancer. And the treatment plan was 3 months of radiation every single day and chemo once a week, cisplatin. And I had to leave my job at the time. I was working with a small art gallery and it was really hard because I'm a single mother of three. But I just kind of, it just went so fast. I was just told I had kin cancer. I did whatever I needed to do to get rid of it. And treatment was really brutal, but, I managed somehow. And then, so I completed treatment in 3 months. I was told everything looked good. And then in my so that was in August. And then my follow-up in November, they had a PET scan and found out then that my cancer had metastasized to my lungs and liver. And not really knowing and understanding what that even meant. The moment they told me that, when he said it had metastasized to my lungs, I just thought I had lung cancer. They didn't really educate me on that. And I didn't really educate myself on that, because they made it seem like, cervical cancer is relatively common and easily treatable at the early stages. But, they didn't tell you the chances of it spreading or anything adversely happening. And especially considering I was on treatment actively, I didn't think that, you know, anything could happen. But come to find out, they were only scanning me from the waist down. And so they didn't see that my cancer was spreading in my organs. So at that point, you know, I asked what this looked like. And he said that I was looking at anywhere from 6 to 24 months to live. Because once it metastasizes, there's really nothing they can do. They can't control it. And there's only so many treatment options that you'll have at that point. And so I was like kind of flabbergasted by this at that point, because I'm like, you know, 6 to 24 months, even if I do chemo. And he's like, if you don't do chemo, you're looking at as little as 3 months. And so 32 years old, again, single mother of three, I was at a loss. Like, I mean, it was devastating. And I just kind of, you know, I had my big cry and I, you know, I had my breakdown and I was just like, you know, this isn't really going to work for me. You know, like I didn't have any viable options of anybody to take care of my kids. I knew that I had no choice but to figure this out. And, you know, so I did. I mean, I began reading a ton. I talked to whoever I could. I went to go get a second opinion. Since I lost my job the first time, I just started working with UNC Chapel Hill. So I kind of took advantage of the fact that I had this UNC email address. And so I just started emailing like every physician, even if, you know, their specialty wasn't even gynecology, just anybody who would help me and just look at my scans. And so I finally found a doctor that would see me. And, you know, while she agreed that it wasn't ideal, she was like, you're young and you're a mom and I'll do whatever I can to help you. And that's all I needed to know. I mean, just, I didn't need you to lie to me and say that you'll be fine, but just if I'm committed to trying to get better, like, I just want somebody else to be equally committed. And she did. I started treatment within like a few weeks. I did explore some clinical trials for immunotherapy, but the closest trial was about 2 hours away. And I didn't really feel comfortable, you know, being so far away in case anything happened, because it was an early phase trial. And so I decided to do the chemo. But so I started treatment, but I also focused on the things that I could control in my life, right? So took a better control of my stress. I've always been just very like manic, you know, just very on the go. And, you know, I never knew how to chill. I'm sun up to sundown. I just never take a minute to myself, chasing the kids around and never really prioritize myself. And so I learned the importance of like kind of slowing down and taking care of me. And, you know, I started eating a lot better. My diet hadn't historically been bad, but, you know, at the end of the day, when you're taking care of kids and working, you know, eating the kids' chicken nuggets and whatever else is there, you know, that's what I do. But I was just more thoughtful of my diet. And, you know, the first round of treatment, I was really tired, but I didn't really try to push myself at all. But this time, you know, I was really glad to get the job at UNC Chapel Hill. And I didn't want to let that go. So I just pushed through. I went to work every day. I took the kids to school and I tried to make sure I was at all their events. And I kind of just, it was like mind over matter. Like I was trying to prove that I was okay. And while proving that I was okay, I ended up feeling okay. It was weird. And because this treatment was even more brutal. Like I didn't lose my hair. I didn't the first time. Like, I mean, I was exhausted and I had like, you know, a lot of side effects, but this was just awful. But I faked it till I made it. My kids were young and they're in middle school and those are weird ages. And so I didn't want them to feel weird. And so like, you know, I put on a wig and a baseball hat and, you know, go to the games and everything. And I don't know, just doing all that made me feel good and they were happy. And so by trying to take control of, you know, my environment and my life and my diet and my lifestyle, I think it all worked together for good. And at the end of my treatment, you know, I had a really good response to the chemo. And so they were going to recommend me for CyberKnife, which is not something that they would typically do for a metastatic patient with cervical cancer, from what I understand. And then when I went to go get that PET scan to determine exactly, you know, where the treatment should go, they actually saw my PET scan that the cancer that they thought was left was actually like calcified tissue. And there was no cancer left. And so I didn't have to get any more treatment. And I was told that I was in remission. And it was crazy. I mean, to thinking about that, you know, just to go from being told that I only had a mere few months to live to being in remission is incredible. And I'm an empath, and all I could think about is just the people that wouldn't have done that. The people that are told these kind of things at these appointments and just kind of give up. And, you know, there are situations where there isn't more that can be done, but in a lot of situations, you know, there is something that can be done. And it just took me being really strong-willed, really stubborn, and just advocating for myself and, you know, not willing to take no for an answer. And I mean, ultimately, I feel like that's why I was able to achieve remission. And that was 4.5 years ago.
I mean, just goes to show how important it is that you are your biggest advocate. And so how long was the process of like the time period from when you were first diagnosed to when you were told you were in remission?
So when I was first diagnosed, it was May 2016, and that was for the stage 2. And then remission was August of 2017.
Got it. And so you kind of mentioned wanting your kids to feel comfortable and, you know, trying to like wear a baseball cap, whatnot. How did you sort of explain things to them and help them process it along with you?
So at first, you know, I didn't really know what to share, and I didn't want to scare them. You know, just the term cancer in general is really scary. And so I basically just presented it to them like, hey, I have this thing. And it's okay. I mean, it's not okay. I mean, it sucks, but I'm going to do whatever I have to do to be okay, because I want to be here with you. And so every single day I get up, just know that that's the first thing on my mind. How can I beat this today? How can I get rid of this? And that's exactly what I did. Like I told myself, I actually had it written down. Like, what are you going to do to beat cancer today? Is it going to be something you choose to eat or choose not to eat? Is it going to be, you know, a thought? Is it going to be whatever it is? I had a journal, and that's exactly what I thought every single day. And that's what I told them, you know, it's not great, but situations like this happen all the time. It's just a matter of, you know, doing whatever you have to do to get healthy. And there were definitely hard days, but I just kept bringing them back to that. Like, I've got this.
And so another thing I think would be really helpful to people is, you know, the aspect of not having insurance. You know, what any other advice you might have for people? Could you just share, you know, what kind of helped you?
Yeah. So a lot of research went into figuring out everything. Because not only, you know, do you have the aspect of not having health insurance, but, you know, being in the situation that I was in, I had to find resources for everything. I mean, like I said, I had to leave my job. So I had to find an organization that would help me with school supplies when the kids had to go back to school. And I had to find organizations to help with food. And it was just, there's no easy way to navigate it. But the first thing I did was the local health department was helpful. I mean, to an extent. I mean, I think that I've learned that people haven't historically been very educated in cervical cancer in general. And so I kind of chalk a lot of like the misdiagnosis or undiagnosis because of, you know, due to that. But anyway, I used the health department, and there's always, you can always find somebody. And I ended up talking to like a receptionist there. And she's like, I see that you're struggling. I see that you're having a hard time. And then she gave me a number to how I found out about these residents at UNC who do the biopsies. And so from there, I just figured out ways to, I just found different contacts at different places, even if it didn't even seem applicable at all to what I was going through. I was just looking for a number to find something, for a resource or something that's low cost or anything. And then I did come across a lot of community clinics that do these screenings for you on a regular basis and do connect you to the people that you need to get connected to. But I think a good place to start is like, you know, a local social services or a community health clinic. And, you know, it helped me kind of navigate things.
So you kind of mentioned that you feel like there's a lot people misunderstand about cervical cancer. What do you think more people should know? And then maybe just like what is most commonly misunderstood in your experience?
Well, I don't think that it's stressed enough, the connection to HPV and cervical cancer. People don't understand, you know, why you need to get these pap smears. if that was more universally understood, that if you get these pap smears and you get these HPV tests, you can catch this early and you can prevent it from turning into cervical cancer. You know, that's important. Like, you know, I just recently learned that people go to the dermatologist on a regular basis, you know, to have full body scans for, you know, melanoma and skin cancers. I didn't even know that. And so if I'm 30 something years old and still making that connection, you know, people my age or older might not make the connection that this is preventative for cancer. And so I just think that that's kind of a misconception that people need to understand. And also destigmatizing HPV in general, like literally, if you've ever had sex in your life, you could get HPV. You know, it's not something that there's nothing wrong with you. It doesn't make, you know, it doesn't make you gross or, you know, I think that more people felt comfortable talking about it and it was more normalized, then so many more people could be reached and they would feel more comfortable talking about it. So those are kind of the biggest things to me.
Right. Destigmatizing is such an important part of it. So how did you become involved with SHARE? And can you tell me a little bit about the new resources and the cervical cancer program?
Yeah, so it's kind of crazy. I've been working at UNC for the past 5 years, and I've been trying to get involved in anything patient advocacy related. And I, through one of my connections there, somebody at SHARE was looking for some advice to start their cervical cancer program. And she asked if I would be willing to give them some advice as a cervical cancer survivor. And so I talked to her, Ivis, she's amazing. And she was kind of picking my brain. And then we ended up talking and she's like, you know, it turned into just a super long conversation. And she determined that, like, I think you would be great to help with this program. And I really love that they want that perspective just before anything even transpired, just the fact that they want to understand these specific cancers so much that they utilize resources to reach people that it is affected firsthand is really unique and special. I started working with them developing the cervical cancer program. And it's really amazing because it's complete full circle moment, you know, to go from being a patient and having to try to navigate these resources to being the person that's putting together these resources for people like me. So it's kind of beautiful. And I mean, even from the beginning, like as I've been working with Maggie, the ovarian cancer program director, and we've been developing content for the website that's very thoughtful. And from a patient perspective and from a public health perspective, and then, you know, medically vetted, but also just thinking about every step of the way and just really trying to give people as much information as they need. And another component of that is like the educational programs, you know, just thinking about the information that I know is needed from a patient perspective. You know, being able to develop that. We had our first program last week, and then we have our next program next week. And it's actually my oncologist that's going to speak. And it's just watching everything come together is great.
Amazing. Such great resources for people to have. So going from like 2016, receiving your diagnosis to now, you became an advocate for yourself in the process. And then now you're advocating for other people. Like, what is the biggest thing that you learned about yourself throughout all of this?
The biggest thing I learned about myself is that to just not give up on things. You know, I've always pushed through and I've always persevered in different, you know, aspects of my life, but it wasn't with not feeling defeated a lot of the time. I had to retrain my brain instead of like feeling like things are like happening to me, like it's happening for me. Honestly, it sounds weird, but like this cancer diagnosis was probably the best thing that's ever happened to me because of how it's reprogrammed my brain. I literally feel like I can do anything. And so it's mind over matter is so important. If you believe in something, you can make it happen. And it's like all these like cheesy sayings that I've always hated ended up being, you know, what's motivated me the most. You can push through and things will get better. And it does. And so by my experience made me believe that, you know, anything is possible.
Well, so thank you so much for sharing your story and for sharing all of that advice. I think it'll be really, really helpful to people. Is there anything that we didn't talk about that you wanted to add that you feel like is important for people to know?
just, get your screenings, stay on top of your health. I mean, you know your body better than anybody. So the moment you feel like anything is off, always advocate for yourself and get it checked out.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Cancer Horizons podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or other apps to hear every episode, or visit curetoday.com/podcasts. The Cancer Horizons podcast is the official podcast of Cure Magazine, the indispensable guide to every stage of the cancer experience. For more information, visit us at curetoday.com and find us on Twitter at @cure_magazine or Facebook at @curemagazine.